This is continuing coverage of the case against Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
What exactly is wrong with Lori Vallow Daybell? If you came here to find out, you're in the right spot. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a doctor. I can't diagnose her. Many others have, though, and many others have speculated, and that's what we're going to be doing on this episode. We are actually going to go through the clinical diagnosis of what the hell is going on in the mind of Lori Vallow Daybell as best as we can understand it. It's really hard to put yourself in a brain like that, but we're going to do our best to kind of connect the dots from piece to piece. And sometimes once you get a better idea of how that brain works, things make a little more sense in a situation where not a lot makes sense. So let's dive into it. And I want to hear your comments in the comment section on our YouTube channel, if that's where you're watching this. If you're listening to the podcast, hey, check out our YouTube channel, join in our conversation over there. Please press subscribe wherever it is you're watching or listening to us so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case and the many cases that we follow for you right here at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. So it's not every day you hear someone calmly say, Jesus knows that no one was murdered in this case at their own sentencing for the murders of their own children. But that's what exactly took place when Lori Vallow Daybell was in court. She stood in court looking serene, almost radiant, and delivered a closing monologue that sounded more like a spiritual TED talk than a statement from a convicted killer. She talked about near-death experiences, how her kids were communicating with her from beyond, and how, in her words, everyone was happy now. Not grieving, not traumatized, just happy. It was one of those moments that made the entire courtroom pause, like, did she just say that? And yeah, she did. No. Flinching, no cracking voice, no visible grief, and that's not just disturbing, it's clinically significant. Because the woman standing there wasn't just detached or cold. According to the experts who spent months evaluating her, she was operating inside a completely different reality, not metaphorically, literally. And you need to understand that if you're going to try and understand Lori Vallow Daybell. In 2023, ahead of her murder trial, Lori Vallow Daybell underwent a full psychiatric evaluation by a court-appointed mental health professional. This wasn't some defense tactic or PR move. It was of the legal process. Idaho law requires that a defendant be mentally competent to stand trial. That means they have to understand what's going on, who the players are, what they're being charged with, and be able to assist in their own defense. Now, sounds fancy, doesn't it? Sounds like, oh, that's quite a bar to get up to. it's like if the goalpost in a field football field just tipped over, fell into a ditch, were washed down a river, put into a canyon as the river overflowed, and now your goalposts are about 500 feet below sea level. When they were at level, that's where they're at. It's not a high bar. It should be high, but it's not. And for a while, Lori did not meet that bar, not surprisingly. She was actually ruled incompetent back in 2021 and sent to a state hospital for months of restorative treatment. Something I think we'll look back on in history going, oh, restorative treatment. What a funny idea that is for someone like her. What the hell were they thinking back then? But after nearly a year of being medicated, monitored, and treated by professionals, the judge ruled her competent. She was cleared to face trial. And that's important because it tells us two things right off the bat. One, that her mind had at least outwardly stabilized enough to engage with the legal system, at least according to the court-ordered psychologist, which I think you'd have a lot of other psychologists not exactly agreeing with that assessment. But, you know, who am I? And two, that there was a detailed, formal psychological profile sitting in her court file. And when that profile was revealed to open court, it laid everything bare. According to the official diagnosis, Lori Vallow Daybell was suffering from what's called delusional disorder, mixed type, with bizarre content and hyper-religiosity. It's a word I have a hard time saying. That was the primary diagnosis. She was also diagnosed with a personality disorder, unspecified, with narcissistic and histrionic features. Again, not a shock. Now, let's break that down without sounding like a psych textbook. Delusional disorder isn't your run-of-the-mill anxiety disorder, okay? Or depression. It's a severe psychiatric condition where the person has fixed false beliefs, delusions, if you will, that aren't grounded in reality, but that they believe with absolute conviction. And when we say fixed, we mean concrete. You can show them evidence, videos, eyewitness, DNA, and they won't budge. The belief is locked in. What sets it apart from something like schizophrenia is that the person doesn't necessarily lose touch with all aspects of reality. Not all. They might still pay their bills, go to work, cook dinner, but there's a segment of their thinking that's completely unhinged and protected like it's sacred truth. In Lori's case, those delusions were labeled as mixed type. You know, a better mix of the 80s, 90s, and today. Strange delusions, wanting to kill your kids, thinking they're zombies. Everything that makes you feel good and picks you up in a no-repeat workday guarantee. That means more than one kind, not just grandiose, not just whatever the hell was going on there, not just religious, a little bit of everything. But the key phrase the psychologist added was bizarre content with hyper-religiosity. That's not just a technical description. That's a clue. It means her beliefs weren't just extreme. They were objectively implausible. Stuff that's completely detached from the physical laws of the world, like believing that people can become zombies. Or that someone's spirit can be taken over by a demon named Ned Schneider. It's not a metaphor. It's not metaphorical. In her mind, these were real conditions that required real-world solutions. The hyper-religiosity part is important, too. It doesn't mean she was religious. It means her religious beliefs were driving her delusions. They weren't personal faith practices. They were the framework for a whole alternative universe, complete with spiritual rankings, divine missions, and what she believed was God's plan, in which she played the starring role. And then there's the personality disorder. It wasn't specified down to one type because she didn't check every box for any single category, but the traits that stood out were narcissistic and histrionic. And yes, they can overlap. They do in many people. Just a lot of people don't end up killing their kids thinking they're zombies. Narcissistic meaning a persistent need for admiration, a sense of entitlement, and a profound lack of empathy. And histrionic meaning attention-seeking, dramatic, superficial, emotional displays. Think of it as a kind of person who believes they're the center of the universe and performs like it's a stage. The two traits together often create a very toxic cocktail of self-importance, manipulation, and emotional detachment. And that fits the courtroom version of Lori Vallow Daybell to a T. The way she carried herself in court was off. Observers described her as serene, even upbeat. She'd smile, whisper to her attorneys, flip her hair. At one hearing, she was caught laughing while the judge was speaking. When footage from the jail was shown, graphic, heart-wrenching evidence of what had happened to her kids, she showed no emotion. She left the room at one point. But when she came back, it was as if she'd reset. stone-faced, not devastated, not even uncomfortable. And then came the sentencing statement. No apology, no acknowledgement of guilt, just a monologue about God, angels, and her dead children being happy and busy. You know, they're working at the Costco in heaven, in the afterlife. She said she knew this because they had visited her. According to her, Jesus confirmed there had been no murders. She spoke about vibrations, spiritual planes, and near-death experiences, as if that should, you know, clear things up. She was talking to a judge who had just overseen a months-long trial with DNA, digital footprints, witness testimony, autopsy reports, and she looked him in the face and basically said, "You've got it all wrong. I know the truth. Jesus told me." Now again, the court found her competent, which means she was rational enough to follow along with the legal process, speak with her attorneys, and understand the charges. But the diagnosis of delusional disorder tells us that within that outward rationality, there's a closed loop of belief that's untouchable. The delusions don't need to affect every part of your life to be dangerous. In her case, they affected the part that involved deciding who was good, who was evil, and who needed to die. And what makes this especially disturbing is how those personality features bolstered the delusions. It wasn't just that she believed bizarre things. It's that she believed she was the one chosen to carry them out. The narcissistic traits gave her the confidence, the righteousness, the immunity to guilt. The histrionic traits helped her draw others into her orbit, even in court. She behaved as if she were misunderstood, not monstrous. It was theater. But theater with a deeply disturbed subject and script. The diagnoses didn't come out of nowhere. They were based on months of psychiatric observation, structured interviews, and behavioral analysis. And what's important to note is that this wasn't a tool for her defense. In fact, Idaho doesn't even have an insanity defense, so this wasn't a strategy. It was a clinical necessity. The state needed to know whether she could stand trial, and when they looked into it, what they found wasn't someone pretending to be unstable. It was someone whose entire worldview had taken a hard detour from reality, and who still, to this day, believes she's on the right side of something bigger than all of us. The court didn't have to speculate. They had evaluations, reports, witness testimony, and their own words. What they saw was a person whose mind was broken, but not so broken that she couldn't sit in court and smile through it. That's the thing about delusional disorder. It doesn't always look like chaos. Sometimes it looks like calm. Sometimes it looks like conviction, charm even. And sometimes it looks like a mother who murdered her children but swears she's saving souls. Whatever Lori Vallow Daybell is thinking now, it's not happening on the same channel as the rest of us. The court said she was competent, but the diagnosis confirms that she's still living in a world of her own making. Before Lori Vallow Daybell stood in court smiling through a murder conviction, before she claimed Jesus told her no one was really dead, and long before anyone had dug up the shallow graves of her children on her boyfriend's property or husband's property, there was a different version of Lori, a version people remembered from years back. Was it the woman you saw in the orange courtroom monitors? This Lori was a doting mom, bright, charismatic, the kind of person who was always in control of the conversation. She could charm strangers, organize a carpool, even plan a family trip, and recite scripture in the same breath. She was also the type who seemed to swing hard, whether in love, faith, or fury. Her world operated in absolutes. You were either on her team or you weren't. And if you weren't, things got cold fast. Before everything unraveled, Lori had already been through a string of relationships, 5 marriages to be exact, but who's counting? that nowhere in those early chapters was there any sign of violence, let alone murder. Custody battles, yes. Restraining orders, one. Emotional intensity, definitely. But not the kind of psychology that made national news or pathology that made national news. People close to her described her as a passionate, even obsessive woman at times, especially about her faith. She was raised in the LDS Church, Mormon, and that identity shaped a lot of her early adult life. But even within that community, Lori's belief would eventually take a hard turn into something unrecognizable. By all accounts, the breaking point, the spark that lit the fuse, the man named Chad Daybell. He wasn't a celebrity. He wasn't a scholar. He was a former cemetery sexton. And if you're playing along at home and don't know what that means, gravedigger, who'd reinvented himself as an end times author. Think doomsday fiction mixed with theology, published under the radar and passed around among circles already leaning towards apocalyptic thinking. Chad wasn't just writing stories. He believed in what he was selling. According to his own accounts, he'd had near-death experiences that gave him a veil-thin connection to the spirit world. He claimed he could communicate with the dead, see beyond the physical realm, and knew who was destined to survive the coming apocalypse. It's niche stuff, sure, but for somebody already teetering between devotion and delusion, it can become gospel. Lori first encountered Chad's work around 2018. At the time, she was still married to Charles Vallow and living in Arizona. On the outside, it looked like a normal suburban life. Inside, things were starting to shift a little. Lori began reading Chad's books obsessively. Then, she attended a religious conference where Chad was speaking. That meeting turned into a connection, and the connection quickly turned into a shared belief system. Some have referred to what they built together as a cult. But at that point, it was really just two people feeding each other's fantasies until they felt the truth, or like they had the truth. Lori, according to friends, started saying she had lived past lives. She had been someone important. That she was chosen. Then when her language started changing, she wasn't just talking about God or scripture anymore. She started using phrases like zombies, translated beings, dark spirits. Chad had developed a system where people could be rated on a spiritual light-dark scale. If you were a light spirit, you were safe, good, even celestial. Haven't y'all wanted to be celestial at some point? But if you were labeled dark, that meant your soul had either been overtaken or replaced entirely. And if you had a life insurance policy, they liked that. Lori picked up on this quickly. She started labeling people around her, friends, family, even her own kids. And it wasn't playful name calling. It was their belief system. Once someone was declared dark, or worse, a zombie, Dawn of the Daybell, they were no longer fully human. Their body was seen as occupied, corrupted, expendable. It was spiritual warfare masquerading as a personality conflict. Still, at this point, no crimes had occurred, but the ideology was getting sharper, stranger, and more rigid. Lori didn't just believe in end times prophecy. She started identifying as one of the chosen few. Chad told her she was an exalted being, and she ate that shit up. He said she lived multiple probations, lives essentially, lifetimes, and had been royalty, even, and this is what she really liked, a goddess. Whoa, ho, ho. Don't pull that rug out from under Lori. Lori embraced that role, to say the least. She believed she was one of the 144,000 souls chosen to survive the end of the world and lead others into the next phase. That number, 144,000, comes from the book of Revelation. But in Chad and Lori's world, it wasn't just a number. It was a mission. Around the same time, Lori began withdrawing from her existing life. Her marriage to Charles was crumbling fast. Charles became alarmed, not just because his wife was getting more religious, but because her behavior was becoming unrecognizable. She told him he was possessed by a dark spirit named Ned Schneider. I don't know where you go with Ned Schneider, but okay. She claimed that he had already died spiritually, and something evil was living inside of the shell, essentially, of Charles. Charles didn't shrug this off. He went to the police. They didn't do anything. He told them his wife was mentally unstable and that he feared for his life. Again, nothing. That's where I think the police really need a close look at here in terms of how they responded to this thing. He even filed a petition to get her evaluated. And for a moment, the system responded. Lori was taken in for a brief psychiatric evaluation in early 2019, but it didn't stick. She talked her way through it. The doctors didn't see enough evidence to hold her involuntarily, and within a few hours, she was released. You know, see something, say something, nothing happens. Charles, meanwhile, tried everything he could think of, therapy, legal filings, law enforcement reports to try to protect his family and bring Lori back to reality. But the further he pushed, the deeper she went, and it wasn't just Chad whispering in her ear. Lori had a growing circle of followers, friends, acquaintances, and even family members who were drawn into the strange spiritual structure she was helping build. Some of them were true believers. Others may have just been riding the charisma train. Or they were just batshit crazy. But the effect was the same. Lori was insulated from doubt. She was surrounded by affirmation. She wasn't wrong. She was chosen. One of the most telling moments came when Lori started referring to her teenage daughter, Tylee, as dark. It's unclear exactly when this shift happened, but it marked a dangerous milestone. Up until that point, Lori's apocalyptic talk had focused on outsiders, on enemies, or on people who disagreed with her. Now it was moving inward. She began viewing her own children through the same binary lens, light or dark, ally or threat. When someone you love becomes an obstacle to your mission and you believe that obstacle is no longer fully human, it changes the moral math. It creates a loophole, a crack in the ethical wall. That crack widened fast. By mid-2019, Lori's behavior had changed so much that even those closest to her were a bit confused. She was talking about portals and spirit communication as if it were as mundane as grocery shopping. She claimed to have divine access, that God spoke to her directly, that she could see into other realms. She and Chad were texting back and forth constantly, talking about spiritual battles and timelines for the end of days like you do. At one point, they created a spreadsheet. Yes, an actual spreadsheet, like an Excel, of people and ranked them based on how closely or close they were to God or how possessed they had become. That's not religion. That's a filter for who lives and who doesn't. It's worth noting that Lori didn't see any of this as extreme. To her, it wasn't fringe or fanatical. It was revelation, enlightenment. She didn't think she was losing control. She thought she was finally stepping into her purpose and more in control than anyone else. That's part of what makes these belief systems so dangerous. They don't announce themselves as madness. They arrive as clarity, a new lens, as if you're already inclined toward black and white thinking, if you're already used to flipping the switch on people who challenge your reality, then that new lens feels like a gift, feels like the truth. And by the time summer 19 rolled around, Lori Vallow Daybell wasn't just a woman in crisis. She was a woman convinced she had divine authority, that certain people were no longer people, that the world was ending soon, and she'd been handpicked to help shape what came next. And that's the version of Lori that walks straight past red flags, legal warnings, and mental health interventions like they were static in the background. She wasn't ignoring reality. She was replacing it. Of course, belief systems, even extreme ones, aren't crimes, but they can become the scaffolding as horrific acts. And when those beliefs begin to justify erasing the people around you, that's when the dissent stops being theoretical. That's where the real-world consequences start. There's a photo of Lori Vallow Daybell taken not long after her children disappeared. She's smiling, lays around her neck, standing on a beach in Hawaii with her new husband, Chad Daybell. The sun is out, waves behind them, and she looks radiant, relaxed. You wouldn't think, just from that image, that back in Idaho, police were searching for her kids, that her teenage daughter and her adopted 7-year-old son hadn't been seen in weeks. You wouldn't think there were questions swirling about where they were or if they were even still alive. You certainly wouldn't guess that they were buried in a shallow grave behind Chad's house. That's the thing about Lori Vallow Daybell. Once her belief system locked in, she didn't live in the same version of reality as the rest of us. She lived in Lori Land. And in Lori Land, what she was doing didn't feel like running from the truth. It felt like walking in it. Let's rewind again. Back to July 2019. Charles Vallow, Lori's then husband, is dead, shot by Lori's brother, Alex Cox, during what was officially ruled a case of self-defense. Charles had come to Lori's house that morning to confront her about her mental state and try once again to get help for their son, JJ. What happened inside that house is still debated. But what's documented is that Charles ended up dead on the living room floor, and Lori didn't seem all that fazed. Police body cam footage from just hours after the shooting shows her outside the house, smiling, even joking with officers. She tells them it was a traumatic morning, but she doesn't look shaken. She's light, casual. You think someone just ran over her mailbox, not that her husband had been shot in front of her kids. Later that day, she ordered pizza, took JJ to Burger King, made plans. The world kept spinning. Lori spun right along with it. This wasn't the behavior of someone covering their tracks. It was the behavior of someone who didn't think they had anything to hide. Because in Lori's mind, Charles wasn't Charles anymore. He had been overtaken, possessed. And when you got someone that's possessed, well, in Lori land, you got to kill him. Replaced by something evil. And once that switch flipped, once she accepted the idea that he was no longer her husband, but a dark spirit in his skin named Ned Schneider, his death wasn't a tragedy, it was a necessity. Justified, maybe even righteous. And that's where you start to see just how far her delusion had taken her. Not just in belief, but in behavior. Her emotional reaction didn't line up with what had actually happened. But it made perfect sense inside the alternate moral universe she had created with Chad. And Chad, by the way, wasn't just a background character during all this. He was a full co-author of the fantasy. The two of them existed in a feedback loop, what psychologists called a shared psychosis, or a faux adieu. It's a rare phenomenon, but not unheard of. Two people, usually close, romantic partners, siblings, develop a thing. And they reinforce the same delusion with each other. Often it starts by one of them. The other buys in, and before long, it becomes their shared reality. In Chad and Lori's case, it wasn't beyond conspiracy thinking. They believed they were on a divine mission to prepare for the end of the world. They believed they could spiritually assess people, assigning them light or dark ratings. They talked about zombies, again, not in pulp culture like they were watching the latest episode of The Walking Dead, but as people whose bodies were now under the control of evil spirits. In their minds, once a person became a zombie, their soul had already departed. Killing the body did not end a life. It released it. It's almost humane in their mind. This is how murder gets reframed as salvation. So when JJ and Tylee disappeared in September of 2019 and Lori told no one and made up stories about where they were, it wasn't just deceit, it was delusion with structure. She told people JJ was with friends, Tylee was at college, she sent texts from her phones. She even lied to police when they came knocking. But when you looked at her during those moments, during interviews, during phone calls, she was not frantic. She wasn't nervous. She was calm, smiling. She'd laugh, make jokes, deflect like it was nothing. Told her friend Melanie Gibb that Tylee had become a zombie, though. Like you do. That JJ, he had become a zombie, too. In her version of reality, that meant the kids weren't really her kids anymore. They were vessels. Shells. And the ultimate example of compartmentalization, a defense mechanism where the mind walls off one part of reality from the rest, Lori could live one life in Hawaii, newly married, tan, and happy, while her kids were decomposing in Chad's backyard. She could go to the beach, sip a drink, order wedding rings online, all while investigators are trying to locate her children. The whore and the honeymoon existed in two separate files in her brain, and she never let them overlap. That kind of psychological splitting is what it's called. Doesn't happen overnight. It's usually the result of a deep internal conflict, cognitive dissonance that becomes too uncomfortable to bear. On one hand, Lori saw herself as a good mother, a chosen leader, a woman fulfilling God's plan. On the other hand, the reality was her children were dead, and she was involved. So how do you reconcile that one? Well, you don't. Not in the traditional way. You shift the narrative. In Lori's case, that meant reframing everything. She didn't kill her children. She saved them. The spirits, or their spirits, were free now. They were happy. Still with her, just in a different form. She wasn't a murderer. She was a liberator. And because her delusion was so complete, she could cling to the idea that, with total conviction, this was real. Even after the bodies were found, JJ wrapped in plastic and duct tape, Tylee dismembered, melted, and burned in a bucket in Chad's backyard. Even then, Lori stuck to the script. She told the court she had spoken with them. That they visited her from the spirit world, that they were at peace. She said they were busy and happy. On the other side, she said no one had been murdered, that everything that happened was part of a divine plan. This wasn't just denial in the casual sense. It was a full-blown cognitive self-protection, a mental firewall against guilt. And the thing is, it worked for her. It seems to still be working for her. When she sat in that courtroom, she did not look like someone bracing for punishment. She looked composed, even amused at times. During testimony, when her only surviving son, Colby, got on the stand to tell her he couldn't understand how she did this, she mouthed, "Oh, my baby," like a mother embarrassed by a moody teen. It wasn't remorse. It was performance, a kind of detached sympathy for someone who just didn't get it. By the time sentencing came around, Lori had had years to process the evidence, to sit with the consequences, but none of it cracked her armor. Not at all. She stood there and delivered a speech that felt like a spiritual victory lap. She didn't address the jury. She didn't apologize. She talked about vibrations, about Jesus, about her children visiting her and Tammy Daybell. She was free now. She denied that a murder had even occurred. Not once did she refer to what had been done to JJ and Tylee. Not once did she say their names in grief. The deaths weren't deaths. They were transitions. Because in Lori land, people didn't die, they ascended. And that's the chilling part, the thing that sticks with you. That even now, after everything, after the evidence, after the trial, the conviction, she still believes she's innocent. Or maybe more than that, she believes She's right. She didn't get there overnight, and she didn't get there alone. But once she crossed that psychological threshold, once she found a belief system that could justify anything, it allowed her to be unthinkable and kept smiling all the way through it. Because once you build a world where good means harm and where harm means salvation and the only truth is the one you create, well, in that world, anything is possible, especially the worst. That's Lori Vallow Daybell for you. What do you think? You understand what's going on there? You agree? Give me your thoughts in the comments on our YouTube channel. If you're listening to the podcast, be sure to press subscribe there and then jump over to YouTube and check us out there and join in that conversation. We put the same audio onto the podcast that's on the videos and vice versa. So you can take us anywhere and just listen when you're in the car or wherever you're doing, going for a walk through the woods alone late at night. Might not be the best place, but hey, to each their own. We want to hear your thoughts, though, in the comment section, so please do do that. And press subscribe so you don't miss any of our commentary, video, interviews, all of that here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. We'll talk again soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.